Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, January 24th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital at its Center for Wound Healing and Hyperbaric Medicine. Diagnostic and treatment options, including hyperbaric oxygen therapy for problematic non-healing wounds for all ages, saratogahospital.org. Joining us today is Dr. Maria Voznesensky of Capital Region Urology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners. Get your calls in early if you have a urology question. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll meet Dr. Maria Voznesensky after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday is urologist Dr. Maria Voznesensky of Capital Region Urology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners Medical Associates. Dr. Voznesensky is board certified in urology and practices general and female urology. She specializes in pelvic floor reconstruction and minimally invasive surgery. Her professional interests include female urology, urethral stricture disease, and male impotence and incontinence. If you have a question about urology, impotence, or incontinence, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well, voxpop@wamc.org. And it's all first come, first served. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Voznesensky, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you back on the program. You know, in the lead-in to your appearance here, I mentioned minimally invasive surgery. If there's one thing most of us don't think of when they think of urology, it's minimally invasive. How has technology made your job easier and the outcomes better?
Sure, that's a good question. So actually, urology was one of the leading specialties to adopt robotics, which is sort of now equated with minimally invasive. And it's allowed us to do a few really great things, such as get patients home faster, speed up recovery by having small incisions that people have to heal from, minimize blood loss. The other thing that robotics does specific to my universe is it allows me to work much more easily in the pelvis, which is a very narrow space that's difficult to get our paws into if we are doing something in an open fashion. So yeah, it's really made, I think, what we do a lot easier. And, you know, this is anything on the bladder, the prostate, the female pelvis, and additionally things up in the kidney area as well.
It's hard to, for those of us who don't do what you do, to visualize what a robot would look like that would actually go in there and perform tasks. How big are these things?
So in general, the way the room is set up, just to paint you a picture, is there is the standard operating table with the anesthesia team keeping the patient asleep. And then there is the robot itself, which actually has kind of a central pillar and then these arms coming off of it. And the total size of it vertically is probably about 5 feet and in width maybe about 3 feet. And these arms, they have adapters that we can attach to them that allow us to do different things like have small scissors, retractors, cautery instruments. And all of these are able to fit through very small, what we call ports, which are teeny incisions. Each one is maybe half an inch at the biggest. And the entire structure is being controlled by a console, which is essentially a remote remote system where I'm sitting over in the side of the room controlling these arms remotely. And then additionally, there's usually a bedside assistant who helps me pass things into and out of the abdomen.
Dr. Maria Voznesensky joins us from Capital Region Urology. The number to call here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. I imagine it took a fair amount of training to actually do this robotic surgery. Does it add a level of nervousness to what you do?
I mean, I think, you know, being cautious and alert, that should be part of everybody's job in medicine. Part of training is to make us comfortable so that we're aware but not afraid, if that makes sense. You know, in residency, you go through a lot of repetitions, and then you practice further in fellowship in some instances, and, you know, you continue learning kind of as a practicing urologist. But, you know, the goal is to always do everything safely, and I think training these days is quite good in making sure that, you know, if you're going to be doing something, you're well qualified before you start.
We're joined today by Dr. Maria Voznesensky of Capital Region Urology. If you have a urology question, impotence or incontinence, give us a call. And, you know, you were on this show, I think, during the pandemic. I can't remember. It was a couple of years ago now, almost, or a year and a half. How has it been trying to maintain some sense of normalcy in your office during this pandemic, which seems to never end?
Yeah, it does feel like a time warp. I remember Cuomo was still the governor because he talked for quite a while at the beginning of the hour, which is my memorable time piece.
That's right.
So other than that, though, I mean, the pandemic continues to be a challenge. You know, the biggest difficulty for surgeons these days, and this is, I think, nationally, not just locally, is between the shortage of staff in the hospital, we're really limited in what we can do. You know, surgery is a team sport. It requires, as you heard, you know, multiple components, anesthesia, assistants, nurses, folks to take care of the patient on the floor, in the recovery area, even if they are going home the same day. So when we're hit with labor shortages across all of these, including anesthesia shortages, and then on top of that, you add limitations to what we can do because of bed availability and kind of statewide mandates. I mean, it's been a tough few years.
Take us through the way that you do pelvic floor reconstruction. It's something I'm not familiar with the process. I understand it can be something of a lengthy process. Explain what you do.
So it sort of depends. You know, it's an all-encompassing term that probably best explained as quality of life surgery for anything below the belt. So in women, that can be incontinence, it can be prolapse. In men, it can also be incontinence and erectile dysfunction. Also, scar tissue within the urinary tract, what we call stricture disease, can affect different levels, anywhere from the kidney down to the exit point, the urethra. So it really kind of depends what and where is affected and what our goals are.
Stricture disease involves scarring. How does the scarring happen?
So a classic example of scar tissue in the urinary tract usually tends to affect men more than women. And common ways that one can obtain this is through trauma. So think of like your skateboarder falling on a rail, you know, straddle type of injury. So any type of trauma can do it. Also side effects from other treatments. So for example, radiation in the urinary tract, if attempting to treat cancer, that can cause the tissues to become damaged and lead to some scar tissue. And then lastly, having had prior procedures such as catheters placed, you know, all of those are kind of the top main risk factors.
Let's take a break here. We're joined today by Dr. Maria Voznesensky of Capital Region Urology. And if you want to get a question in, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org. We'll check the email bag and hit the phones in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's a Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. We're joined today by urologist Dr. Maria Voznesensky of Capital Region Urology. And one email here before we hit the phones. This one is from Robbie. Several questions here, doctor, but they're all very brief, so we'll ask them all in order here. The subject heading is water, beer, vitamins. And Robbie writes, when water was undrinkable, we turned it into anything boiled. How much hydration is actually in beer? You might not know the answer to that, so we'll move on. Is the classic 8 glasses of water still accurate?
So, you know, that is, it depends, is the short answer. The best indicator of hydration status is actually your urine color. It should be a nice, clear, light yellow. Anything on the order of tea-colored is concerning for underhydration. If you ever see blood in there, you should be calling a urologist ASAP. But in general, the urine color is the best indicator. Other factors that are going to affect your need for hydration are things like the weather. If it's hot and you're very active, sweating a lot, you should be hydrating more. But in general, the color, I think, is a good baseline to look at.
And then another question here from Robbie. How much do excessive vitamins affect urology?
So, you know, the body is a balanced system. More is not always better. So we know that excessive vitamins can actually predispose you to a few different things. In my universe, folks who are overdoing calcium can actually predispose themselves to kidney stones. And then we know that certain vitamins are fat soluble. So if you eat too many of them, you can actually raise your levels to dangerously high amounts. Most vitamins that are over the counter, they tend to get filtered in the urine. So, most likely your urine is very expensive and loaded in all sorts of supplements. But, you know, in general, just be cautious with overdoing things like calcium and vitamin C if you want to stay away from kidney stones.
Dr. Maria Vosnesensky joins us today. And let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551, the number. John is in Albany. John, you're on.
Hi, Doc.
Hello.
Can you?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm 64 years old, and I've had type 2 diabetes for, about 17, 18 years. And I experienced impotency, and it came on very, very quickly, like right before my 50s, I would say. It wasn't a gradual thing. And I'm pretty sure it's got something to do with my diabetes. And I've never really looked into it, but I heard you guys talk and I got a little curious. I figured I'd call and ask.
Yes, that's a really good question. So two factors going on. I'll touch on the diabetes in a second. But, you know, age we know is a strong relationship with erectile dysfunction. So for statistical purposes, you know, men in their 50s, 50% of them will have some form of what we call ED, which is, you know, how we abbreviate erectile dysfunction. Men in their 60s, right. 60%, and so on. With diabetes specifically, what's going on is, so erections, there's two components to it. You need blood flow to get to the penis to create the erection, but then you also need nerves to tell the blood vessels to dilate. So we know with diabetes, the nervous system is affected. You know, in really advanced states, you can have people with neuropathy, you know, tingling in their hands and feet. The vision can be affected. And so on a micro level, it's the nerves that are not firing appropriately to send the signals to the penis to basically right. engorge with blood. That's kind of the quick and dirty explanation.
John.
Okay. Is there anything I can do about this? What would you suggest?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, generally where we start, we kind of always try to do things least to most invasive. So least invasive are the erection medications like Viagra, Cialis. Nice thing about them is these days both of those are generic. They used to be pretty cost prohibitive, but they've really become quite affordable, like a dollar per tablet almost. So that's usually where we start. After that, there's things like vacuum pumps, injections, and then at the end of the line is actually one of the things I specialize in, which is making people bionic with a penile implant.
Okay. Yeah, I've noticed that the Viagra doesn't work very well for me, and Cialis doesn't work at all. So.
Okay. Yeah, so,
that's
you know, probably.
A little curious. Go ahead.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, that's kind of the entry level. If that's not doing it, you know, then my personal preference would be to move towards injectable medications, which actually get injected directly into the penis, and they're about three times as strong as the tablets are.
Okay. Oh, that sounds pleasant.
Yeah, it sure does, and good luck with that, John.
It's not as bad as it sounds, and just think about, you know, the net gain that you're going for. So.
You know, there are any number of follow-up questions that I'm going to leave on the table here, Dr. Vosnesensky. And let's go back to the phones. Joan in Schenectady. Joan, you're on.
Hello, and thank you for your very good information, Doctor. I have a question about the aging female body and what one can expect as the years go by. Maybe a decade ago, when I was doing some hiking, was the first time I noticed some incremental leakage from the urinary tract. And now it's been on like this holding pattern. As long as I don't push that first, hey, you might need to go to the bathroom. It's good. And the amount of urine that I can hold shouldn't change as long as I just pay attention to those signals. So what can I expect as we move?
Joan, you're cutting out a little bit, but I think we got the idea. Doctor.
Yes, I think what Joan is asking is looking into the future, where will she be given kind of what's going on now? You know, difficult to say. I would say if you maintain your current level of health, current weight, you know, really don't add any extra risks to, you know, an overall decline in your health. Lots of people continue living as they are. You know, certainly as we age, we tend to kind of collect new health issues, I would say. So in that scenario, it's a little bit hard to predict. But, you know, I think if you're doing well now and you have good coping techniques, which it sounds like you do, nothing to say that this is going to necessarily get worse for you. Hopefully it stays the same.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Joan.
Yeah, good luck.
Appreciate the call. Dr. Maria Vosnesensky joins us today from Capital Region Urology. And the number to call is 800-348-2551. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Before we get back to the emails and the phones, let's go back to the little blue pill you talked about with our last caller. You see the ads everywhere, and not just for that one, but for all of them. And are they overprescribed in this country?
You know, I don't know the answer to that because I'm not certain about the amount of prescriptions that are getting thrown around. So the short answer is I'm not sure. You know, I would hope that they're being prescribed appropriately. I think in my universe, you know, we tend to prescribe more of them than maybe primary care does. But in my experience, I don't think they're overused.
Let's go back to the phones here. Jim and Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Besides urolithes, what other disorders might cause a bifurcation of the urine flow?
So split urinary stream could be just your own anatomy. If you have a little bit of narrowing, maybe at the exit point, what we call the urethral meatus, that's a possibility. If you have scar tissue in there, that's kind of changing the direction of the flow, that could do it. If you are having what we call a bladder spasm, like an episode where the bladder is contracting as part of an incontinence episode, that can create kind of a spurting style stream.
Jim.
That's
okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. And email from Anonymous. And I hope, doctor, that I can pronounce some of these medical terms properly. Only one here that I'll probably screw up. Could you please ask the doctor to speak about options to correct rectocele from delivery of large posterior baby? I'd like to stay anonymous, and that is from Anonymous.
Okay. So you did good. Rectocele. So quite close.
Okay.
Basically, a cele is a prolapse, and recto is, you know, the rectum.
Sure.
So you can have a cystocele where the bladder's coming down, and rectocele is where the rectum is coming down. And so this is a category of trouble labeled pelvic organ prolapse, where different components of the vaginal canal are essentially coming down and sticking out.
Yeah.
So the question of how this can be fixed, there's a couple choices. A non-surgical choice is something called a pessary, which is a plastic insert. It comes in different shapes and sizes and gets fitted at a GYN or urology office that does pelvic floor stuff. And the job of this pessary is to physically kind of push up the organs that are falling down. Then there are surgical approaches where we can essentially lift and tuck the components that are falling down.
We lost the doctor. Are you still there? We're having some dropouts here on the line, and please bear with us.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Dr. Maria Vosnesensky joins us today from Capital Region Urology, and our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We have done many a urology show here on Medical Monday. Ordinarily, immediately you think of male urology. You do a lot of female urology. What is the most common procedure you have to do in female urology?
So I would say most common female urology is a toss-up between kidney stones, because women get those as well, and looking at a combination of pelvic floor dysfunction such as prolapse and incontinence. Those would be the top three that I see.
Let's talk about kidney stones for a minute. What percentage do you think of the American population, if they live long enough, will get a kidney stone? I've never had one. I really don't know what they feel like.
So I would say if you can make it to your mid-50s and 60s without having a stone, you are in good shape and your risk drops off. What? There are some people who have congenital risks for stones because they have a certain what we call errors of metabolism, where they're born processing electrolytes differently. But most people, they tend to get them in about middle age, and usually it's a problem with not drinking enough water.
And if you then decide, well, I'm going to start drinking a lot of water, you minimize your risks, but some people will get them anyway, right? Do they run in families?
They definitely can run in families. Some people, even if they do everything correctly, can just continue to form them. And that's really frustrating and unfortunate. There are a couple stones that we can kind of melt away. Specifically, we call them uric acid stones. They're associated with gout. And those can be preventable if folks are on the correct medications.
We're joined today by Dr. Maria Vosnesensky of Capital Region Urology. The number to call is 800-348-2551 if you have a question. 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org if you wish. You had mentioned one type of stone you can dissolve with basically medication. How many types of kidney stones are there?
So off the top of my head, there's the most common one, which is your standard adult stone, is something we call calcium oxalate. Uric acid stone is the kind that's associated with gout. A stone associated with kidney infections and, kidney infections would be something called a struvite stone. And then another example of a rare one, which is usually kind of a congenital problem, born with a type of problem, would be something called a cystine stone.
And some of these can be dissolved with ultrasound, yeah?
So treatment options for most of them would be, the only one that we can really kind of melt away would be the uric acid stone. Because that one, if we change the acidity of the urine around, sometimes we can shrink it down. But generally, all the others require either going up and getting it through the urinary tract and then breaking up the stone with a laser and pulling out the pieces. Or, as you mentioned, we can use shockwaves to break up the stone with a machine that basically directs shocks at the kidney through outside the body.
That's amazing. A shock of sound, but not a shock of electricity, to be clear.
Correct. No electricity. It creates a sound wave that then gets focused on the kidney stone, and it can break up the stone that way.
It's such a fascinating concept. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, and then lastly, for really big stones where they're just filling up the entire kidney, sometimes people have to have a procedure through the back to where we make a small incision and can place larger tools into the kidney to remove the stone that way.
Old wives' tale or truth? A cranberry juice a day or every couple of days will help you keep the kidney stones at bay?
I'm not aware of any data to support that.
All right, fair enough. Back to the phones we go with Dr. Maria Vosnesensky. Lewis in Wappingers Falls, you're on. Or is it Lois? I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Answer to anything. I have a question about oxybutynin and it causing blurry vision. Is there a different alternative for bladder control?
There is. So oxybutynin is a member of a medication class that we call the anticholinergics. And they unfortunately all have unpleasant side effects like dry mouth, blurry vision, constipation. There's about 8 different medications in that family. The nice thing is that there are actually 2 newer medications that are, they work differently. And they're called Mirbetriq and Gemtesa. Mirbetriq is a little bit older. That's been around, I want to say, at least 10 years. And Gemtesa was approved about 1.5 years ago. And the nice thing is neither of them have those side effects like the blurry vision, constipation, dry mouth. And in fact, they're really the better choices for folks over the age of 65, because we know that medications like oxybutynin, they have some risk of dementia and cognitive side effects.
Oh, very good. Could you spell both of those?
Okay, sure. So Gemtesa is G-E-M-T-E-S-A. And then Mirbetriq is M-Y-R-B-E-T-R-I-Q.
Okay, I think I will inform my urologist.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good luck.
Lois, thanks for the call. Number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And let's go to Merrill in Shutesbury. Merrill, you're on.
Hello, Hi. Doctor. My 98-year-old dad has a tube into his bladder because his bladder stopped working correctly, and he wears... He was wearing a leg bag. Now he's mostly wearing a bag that we sort of try to keep on the low down for him. But he keeps getting urinary tract infections, which is extremely concerning for all of us, and it's been landing him in the hospital. And I'm wondering what we can do to make it safer for him to use this bag, use these bags.
Yeah, so that's a tough situation because if his bladder doesn't empty on its own, you really need a tube to drain it. And we know anytime somebody has essentially a foreign body in there, the risk of infection goes up because now it's not a closed, sterile system. One of the things that's really important to know is that when somebody has a chronic catheter, their urine is always going to be dirty. So it's never going to be sterile. So it's very important to make sure that what we're calling a urinary tract infection really is. So there need to be something more than just the urine being abnormal. You know, ideally fevers, chills, maybe worsening kind of personality difference, or excuse me, worsening mental status changes, something to alert you that, you know, he is not doing well.
Yeah.
He has, yeah. I mean, I would say really the only way then to kind of work at it, besides making sure he's getting routine catheter changes, is make sure he's really well hydrated so the urine is staying flushed. And you could add some supplements like, you know, vitamin C to help acidify the urine. The trouble is, you know, other things like suppressive antibiotics, like a daily antibiotic, that's not a perfect fix either. You know, that only decreases infections by maybe 70%, and then you're building resistance. So it's definitely a difficult situation.
Yeah, he actually does all those things. He gets the catheter change regularly. He drinks a lot of water. He's really good about that. And he does take low-dose antibiotics, but they still keep... Somewhere he's getting, you know, this urinary tract. And he almost died last week, actually. It was so bad.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
He was so weak he couldn't even open his eyes. And he's mostly pretty good. So we're just trying to do something to help him stay safer.
No, I understand. I mean, one thing maybe if you haven't done is getting some imaging to see if maybe he has some kind of nidus for infection, like a stone in the bladder or in the kidneys that could be treated.
Okay.
Just an idea.
Okay, Merrill, we got to take a break here, but thank you so much. It is Urology Today on Medical Monday. We're joined by Dr. Maria Voznesensky, and we'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's Medical Monday Urology today with Dr. Maria Voznesensky of Capital Region Urology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners. If you have a question, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And before we get back to the email bag and the calls, Doctor, let's talk briefly about urinary tract infections. Aside from the scenario you just painted where somebody has a catheter or something like that that causes the infection, what are some ways that people can just get it in regular life?
So, you know, unfortunately, women are much more predisposed to urinary tract infections or UTIs, and that's a function of the fact that their urethra, the tube between the bladder and outside the body, is really short. It's only about 2.5 inches long. So it's really easy for bacteria to go from, outside to inside. Other risk factors also for women, unfortunately, is menopause. We know that with changes in hormonal balance, they can be predisposed to infections after the lining of the vagina and menopausal changes happen. For all comers, not drinking enough water can be a risk factor, and also holding your bladder can be a risk factor too. So you should, be going on a schedule and not going through the whole day without a trip to the bathroom.
Very interesting indeed. You know, you had mentioned, or maybe our caller mentioned, some personality changes. And I have actually seen this with an older male relative who had, finally they discovered it was a urinary tract infection. He went pretty crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things, in folks who maybe are on the older side and don't tell us about how they're doing as much, or, you know, maybe have some dementia or things like that going on, they don't often mount the same type of response to being ill. You know, the fevers and chills often don't come until quite late. And so it can be sometimes, personality changes and kind of, confusion. That can be a sign that something is wrong.
But why personality changes with something that is fairly far from the brain?
Well, I think it's the infection is kind of interfering with their overall normal balance. So let's say they have a little bit of confusion or dementia, you know, anything that puts the body in a mode of stress now can affect that.
Dr. Maria Voznesensky joins us today. We have an email from, it's kind of a long email, from Laura. I was diagnosed about a year ago with a urethral stricture, which I understand is not that common in women. The cause is not known, but the beginning of problems coincided with surgery for which a catheter was needed. The urologist I saw performed a dilation, which was extremely painful, and suggested that the best way to manage it was to do routine dilation whenever necessary. My gynecologist suggested that there may be more humane and permanent procedures to manage strictures in women. Do you have any information on alternatives to dilation that you could share? And that is from Laura.
Yes. So, you know, she's right. Strictures in women are unusual. Besides dilating, one of the things that can be done is you can actually do what's called a urethroplasty, where you can take a piece of healthy tissue, specifically when I do it, I take it from either inside the mouth or near the lining of the vaginal canal, and you essentially put a patch of good tissue to pop open the scarred tube. And then once it heals in an open fashion.
So that's what you would suggest for our patient. And dilation is a painful procedure.
Well, dilation, you know, it can be done under anesthesia, but then it generally requires some maintenance afterwards, such as maintaining the tract open by passing a catheter or, you know, a dilator yourself. Because the trouble with scar tissue in the body is once it's there, it doesn't tend to stay open. The body likes to close it back up again. So the success of just dilating and leaving it alone has about a 50-50 chance of closing back up again.
Let's go back.
You can add a few other factors, like when, you know, after somebody is dilated, if they're then going to self-dilate, they can add a steroid cream that's been shown to help decrease the scar tissue coming back. But generally, if somebody is a good surgical candidate, doing, you know, the repair with putting in a patch of healthy tissue, that tends to have a much higher success rate than just dilations.
Let's go back to the phones now with Dr. Maria Voznesensky. The number is 800-348-2551. Ken is in Earlton. Ken, you're on.
Oh, yes. Hello. I wondered if the doctor could say something about the similarities and or differences between kidney stones and bladder stones. I mean, my question is about really about bladder stones, but I did hear what you had to describe about kidney stones.
So they are different in that bladder stones are usually a sign of the bladder being blocked. Most classically in men, it's the prostate is enlarged and it doesn't allow the bladder to empty 100%. And so the stagnant crystals in the urine inside the bladder can collect into a stone. So we kind of think of them as being a process of blockage of the urinary tract. Whereas, you know, kidney stones form from rarely from a blockage. Usually it's, you know, poor hydration or just bad luck genetically. So different that way.
And the stones that do form in the bladder, if there's blockage, are they the similar stone makeup? Like I think you mentioned calcium is one type, uric acid another, and two other ones.
You know, honestly, we don't think of them as metabolic stones. They usually are made up of calcium, but they're not the kind of thing that we would address by, you know, looking at the components of the urine. Really, the issue there is if somebody's getting these, it means that their urinary tract is blocked and they probably need to have their prostate addressed because that's most likely the source of the trouble.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Ken, thanks a lot for the call. It's Medical Monday on WAMC Urology Today with Dr. Maria Voznesensky, and we have an email here from Frank. Please comment on green light laser treatment for enlarged prostate, risks and benefits. First of all, doctor, what's green light laser treatment? And then you can talk about the risks and benefits.
So green light laser treatment is a type of laser that we can use to ablate the prostate tissue. The benefits of it are that it's good at creating what we call hemostasis. So back when this came out, the big selling point was that you could do procedures for enlarged prostates while keeping people on their anticoagulations, so like aspirin and blood thinners. Technically, you know, it was quote unquote safe. Mm-hmm. It's in that regard, you know, it's good because it controls the bleeding well as at the same time kind of melts away the prostate tissue. Downside with green light, me, and this is, you know, me putting my personal opinion hat on, is that I think it creates a lot of what we call irritative symptoms, meaning afterwards there's a lot of urgency and frequency in the recovery period.
Mm-hmm.
And the other downside is we don't get any tissue for analysis because the tissue essentially is melted away. So, you know, if we wanted to know whether there was maybe any prostate cancer in the specimen, there's really no way to obtain that with green light.
Very interesting. And it's green because of its argon?
The wavelength of the fiber.
Very interesting indeed. Let's go back to the phones. William in Sheffield. William, you're on.
Yes. Could you discuss the use of Myrbetriq, Myrbetriq, 50 milligrams, and finasteride, 5 milligrams. The use of and the dangers of using it for excessive urination.
So the Myrbetriq, that is a medicine that is for overactive bladder. The way it works is it helps relax the bladder and helps you store urine better so that the bladder isn't sending you to the bathroom and telling you that, you know, you have to go. So that's that component. The finasteride is a medication that over time helps to shrink the prostate. So the goal there is to get you a stronger, better urinary stream. So my guess is if you're on both of those, you had some symptoms of both an enlarged prostate and also a bladder that was sending you to the bathroom frequently. As far as risks, Myrbetriq is quite safe. You know, it has very few side effects. One thing to watch out for is you want to make sure that your blood pressure is staying steady on it and not going up. But in general, if your blood pressure is well controlled, it's a very minor risk. And then one of the other common side effects with that one is folks who are predisposed to migraines, it can raise the frequency of those. With finasteride, the most common side effects is, one, it takes about 6 months to reach max benefit. And the way it works is it actually decreases the amount of testosterone, which is fuel to the prostate. So the side effects can be side effects of low testosterone, such as almost like a male menopause. So facial flushing, breast growth, weight gain, drop in sex drive or libido. Those are the main ones.
Thank you, William. We appreciate the call very much. Dr. Maria Vosnesensky joins us on this Medical Monday. It's Urology Today. And this email from Joan in Munson, Mass. Thoughts on hyaluronic acid or Botox for female urinary incontinence for a 70-year-old? And that's from Joan in Munson.
So Botox for the bladder is a very good therapy for folks with overactive bladder. It's what we call one of the third-line treatments. It's actually one of the things I offer in my practice. I think it is very nice, has good success rate. And in general, you know, we expect about an 80% improvement from baseline for folks who have urgency and overactive bladder with the Botox. The hyaluronic acid, that one, you know, not aware of its use for overactive bladder. There's some applications of it for folks with a painful bladder. So I'm not sure if maybe that's what the patient's referring to, or person, excuse me.
I'm not sure, but you had mentioned enlarged prostates a moment ago. And before the next call, we see ads everywhere, over-the-counter herbal remedies. Is there any one of them that does anything?
Short answer is, if you go with published research, the answer is no. Saw palmetto is the most common one that's out there. And there was a really nice randomized trial in, I want to say, JAMA, quite a while ago now, maybe 10 years ago, that showed it really was no better than sugar pill. So, you know, probably not a lot of downside to taking them. You've got to consider the cost. And in my opinion, you know, I don't tend to recommend them.
Dr. Maria Vosnesensky joins us today. Number is 800-348-2551. Susan in Munson. Susan, you're on.
Yeah, hi, thank you. About 12 years ago, I was diagnosed with bladder cancer and was assured that it was the lowest possible level there is. And at my first biopsy, there was a whoops, and the doctor slipped, and I ended up spending the night in the hospital. And every time I have a cystoscopy, that's a problem spot. But if there's anything that shows up at all, I end up having to come back and, you know, having another biopsy. They tell me, oh, that was just scar tissue, or you know, it isn't a problem. But I keep, now instead of going every year, I have to go every 6 months. Is this going to go on forever?
So, you know, bladder cancer is annoying in that way because it does like to come back. And we have special guidelines for how frequently, you know, the looks in the bladder should happen. So, you know, if you keep having recurrences, probably what's happening is they have to keep resetting the clock back to the every 3 months, every 6 months. You know, if you were able to demonstrate for a while that you were cancer-free, then most likely we'd be looking at once a year. But unfortunately, if it keeps creeping back up, you know, it's not a great idea to kind of set you free for that long.
So even if it reoccurs at the scar tissue site, I still should be concerned about, like, that, meaning would it have not come up if I didn't have scar tissue there?
So when you say scar tissue, the area that where it keeps growing back is the same spot where it originally was?
Pretty much, yeah. It's only one time something else came up that was really little, and the doctor said it like this. He said, we don't have to do it right now, but if you wait, it'll get much bigger. We'll do it. I'll give you some medication while you're sitting here for another hour, and it should keep that particular one from coming back. So it seems like I'm always doing something.
Yeah, no, I hear you. But, you know, on the flip side, it sounds like, you know, you're doing a good job keeping up with this and it's not getting out of hand.
You.
But you're right. They can be quite annoying and pesky, and that they do like to come back.
But I should just assume that this is going to be, you know, pretty much for the rest. I'm in my late 60s, so it'll be the rest of my life pretty much, right?
Well, you know, I certainly wouldn't move away far from a urologist at this point.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Susan, thank you for the call. Dr. Maria Voznesensky, got a couple minutes here. Is there something in the future that you see that's just on the horizon that may be a game changer in your line of work?
I'm really excited for the urinary tract infection vaccines, so UTI vaccines. There's some data from Europe where I think they even have one approved. And I think as soon as we have that in the U.S., I'm really hopeful that a lot of the women we see suffering with this will get some improvement in their quality of life.
Now, I have not heard of this. This would be a yearly vaccine?
You know, I can't speak to sort of the frequency of it or exactly the details because it hasn't come up at all in the U.S. literature, but I'm hopeful that, you know, we get some positive news about that coming up soon.
Any technology, we have mentioned robotics and microsurgery, any technology on the future, either in imaging or in actual ameliorating of symptoms that may make your life easier in the next 10 years?
I am still hopeful that some of the bioengineering stuff, like being able to grow people, you know, a new urethra, a new bladder possibly is in the pipeline. That's been cooking for a long time and, you know, still very much in the sci-fi universe and kind of in the lab. But I'm hopeful there as well.
That's fascinating. So this has been, you say, cooking for a long period of time, obviously not approved yet, but how far along are they?
Not really anything that's adapted for human use yet. You know, for example, in urethral reconstruction, there was a group in Italy that looked at essentially creating tissue scaffold and growing people a new urethra, but that hasn't really come onto the market. So unfortunately, still in the lab stages.
Very exciting, though, all the same. Dr. Maria Voznesensky, I think you were on the phone last time we did this. We'll probably have you in the studio next time in 6 months or a year, and maybe the pandemic will be over. In the meantime, I hope you guys at St. Peter's Health Partners keep your morale high. You do good work. And if people want to find out more about what you do, how do they do it on the internet?
So if you Google me and my name, honestly, probably the easiest would be St. Peter's Urology. That would be the simplest because my last name is a bit challenging.
Well, you're telling me. I had to practice for about an hour before. Hey, listen, thanks so much for being here, Doc. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks for having me. I love your show. Thank you.
Thank you. Support comes from New York State Association of Nurse Anesthetists, representing registered nurse anesthetists seeking to practice to the full extent of their education and training, nysana.com/info. One more anesthetist in that underwriting credit, and it would be equal to saying Voznesensky for the hour. But I got it all done. We've done it. And thank you for joining us here on a Medical Monday. Thanks to Dr. Maria Voznesensky of Capital Region Urology for being here today. And thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who once again showed up for work. Good for you, Zach. Our phone's answered today by Tina Rennick. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we'll switch gears a little bit. We'll talk hiking and meet a new guest, Alicia Philly. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. So if you're a hiker, this is the show for you. We'll see you at 2.